Hey everybody, it's that time again when you get all excited, settle down and press play on your iPod to listen to the oneliner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, coming to you from just outside Liverpool. In Glasgow is Scott Morris.
Hello.
And in Falkirk is Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
We've got five fantastic, fun-filled filmic frolics for you tonight, so without further ado, we're going to crack on. X-Men Origins, colon Wolverine, probably needs a little introduction, not least of all because a well-publicised leakage of a workprint made headline news last month. Unsurprisingly detailing the backstory of Hugh Jackman's character Wolverine from the previous X-Men movies, Origins surely has an uphill struggle to convince an audience that a hero already established as indestructible and resolutely alive in time for future events faces any kind of palpable danger. With an expansive cast of hitherto unfilmed X-Men favourites all seeking to cause him more harm than good, can Wolverine ratchet up the requisite suspense, or would your tenor be better off spent on a lower profile release? Drew, what say ye?
I would say that your money would be reasonably well spent. It's a rather entertaining film, and just to get important things out of the way first, it's considerably better than X-Men 3.
That's a low bar.
I know it's a low bar, but I think it's, since that would be people's last experience of the franchise, let's just get that in there to begin with.
Colon cancer better. Would be better than X-Men 3.
Yes, there's no Brett Ratner in sight. Yeah, the problem, as you mentioned, is that how do you have any threat? And so they do this by making other people in danger rather than Wolverine, and he's got to go and help them.
Cool.
Although, to be honest, is there ever any real threat? I mean, do you think Spider-Man's going to die at the end of one of the Spider-Man films, or is that a concern for anyone?
He might get stuck under a gigantic tumbler or something.
Yeah.
And it's meh, your final word subject.
Yes. Meh, dead air. fair enough. did you have anything to add, Drew?
I did. It's sort of gone now. You threw me off by stopping.
I threw you off by not saying anything.
Yes.
Fantastic. Scott, is there anything you would like to expand on whilst Drew recovers his senses?
Well, yeah, I mean, I liked this well enough. I thought it was okay. I think Hugh Jackman continues to be kind of amusing and likeable and charismatic, perhaps maybe more than the character would demand. Liev Schreiber's playing Sabretooth this time round and does a hell of a lot better than that fella that did it in the first film. It's at least an interesting enough little story, although it is something of a fairly pointless one. The main problem I've got with this film is not really any lack of quality in action films. It's all slickly done, it's all polished, and it's all nice enough in terms of just the action elements of it. But most of the other X-Men films at least had some small attempt at social commentary or tried to say something a bit more than just be an action film. And this really genuinely doesn't, and it has many points in it that are just that just seem to have no bearing other than just be fan service. I mean, I've been waiting for years for Gambit to make an appearance in an X-Men film.
Yes.
And he finally does, and it's quite good in this film, and it's quite a good portrayal, and it's all quite fun, and it's all very jolly, but it is entirely pointless, and the character serves no use whatsoever to the actual plot.
Hmm.
He essentially gives Wolverine a lift at one point and has a fight. But it's the whole film
He's there because X-Men fans were champing at the Gambit for him, basically.
Yeah, arf, yeah. Arf. Scott's right, because Gambit could quite easily be replaced in this by a map, possibly a taxi.
Oh no, it's Ordnance Survey Man!
I mean, yeah, possibly even a map so much as a signpost, that would have done. It's that way. Okay, thank you, the character's now dispensed with.
Despite all of that, and I don't know how this fits into the established mythos of the Marvel Universe, I suspect it may not be entirely canonical, so maybe the comic geeks might hate it for that reason alone, but the rest of it, it's fine, but it's just a film that is a shot to nothing. You know how it's going to end, with Wolverine losing his memory, and it does sort of take away any kind of impact that it could have had. I mean, you don't even get any real knowledge about the character, because the character himself has forgotten his knowledge about his character at the end of it, thus leading to the X-Men films. So it just seems entirely pointless. I mean, it's not a bad thing to be an entirely pointless film. It's still an enjoyable enough way to spend 2 hours in the cinema watching this unfold, but it's certainly not even of the same ilk as the first two films.
So very much a superfluous little movie if you happen to have a superfluous £8 knocking about in your pocket then.
Yeah, if you want something not particularly demanding, then it'll fill that hole adequately.
There we go. If you want a retina-searing action experience devoid of intellect for your £8, knock yourself out. Another day, another Asian horror remake. This time it's The Turn of the Uninvited, a remake of Korea's most successful horror film of all time, A Tale of Two Sisters. Emily Browning is Anna, a teenager recently dismissed from a stint in a mental home following the horrific death of her mother in a fire. Returning home to her doting father and cruel stepmother, David Strathairn and Elizabeth Banks respectively, it isn't long before Emily is subjected to terrifying nighttime visitations from hideously scarred figures with contorted faces, not entirely unlike Gordon Brown's recent YouTube videos. Is Anna going straight back to the crazy house, or is there a dark secret behind the death of her mother that will attempt to turn the plot up on its head? The Uninvited actually does a halfway decent job, in my opinion, and it's certainly the least offensive of the current crop of teen-oriented horror bilge flooding multiplexes. That it fails to spark any interest in my increasingly pilloried critical faculties seems more to do with it following in the relentless wake of such tripe as last month's The Unborn. Scott, is that an assessment you'd agree with? I suspect not.
No. While I was watching this, I made detailed notes. Will I repeat them to you verbatim?
If you must.
They go such... Ah, for fuck's sake. And that's it, actually. I'd kind of turned off after that. I just could not be bothered with this film at all. I thought its twists, and I use the term loosely, were so blindingly obvious from the outset that it just had no real impact at all when it actually was unveiled.
Should we not point out at this point, note, that you have seen the original film, haven't you?
No.
Well, I thought you'd seen A Tale of Two Sisters.
I've seen the original, which is why I didn't watch the remake, because the original's really dull.
I didn't even know it was a remake of it until you pointed it out there.
Oh, well, there you go.
That didn't interest me. I thought the acting was risible throughout. I thought it obviously doesn't make any sense from the outset. Loathed pretty much everyone in it, and I just really could not be bothered. It was so dull, in fact, that when I watched this in Armenia, looking out the window in Armenia was more interesting, and you've seen the view I had from the window in Armenia, and it's not very interesting, yet it managed to be more interesting than this. So, yes, Uninvited is gash.
Well, that's possibly the shortest review we've had in the OneLiner.com's 37-episode history. I'm not going to argue with it. Obviously, I didn't think it was as bad as that. I certainly wouldn't recommend it to anyone. I just think in comparing it to pretty much every other horror movie we've had in the last 5 years, it wasn't as bad as those. As I say, that's not exactly necessarily a seal of quality. But the point I would make is, as you said from the onset, you probably couldn't really be bothered with it. And I wonder if that's as much to do with this bombardment we've had of horror tripe simply dulling the senses to the whole genre, which I fear may well have happened. I'm going to have to sit down at some point and watch The Thing again or something like that to remind me that films can actually be scary.
Well, when something comes along that's interesting, we'll give it a fair shake. I mean, there's not an awful lot happening in Let the Right One In, but I've quite enjoyed that for the most part. So
Fair enough.
If something comes along that's actually any good, I'll give it a break. But by this point, I've seen enough really terrible horror films that I don't really need to pay much attention to any new really terrible horror films. If nothing else, it'll start pushing out the memories of all the old really terrible horror films out of my head. So,
its only purpose is to is to shunt the last one in out.
it's just sort of changing the buffer alignment in my brain. So,
oh my goodness. You've got a truncated memory for horror films. Well, how much space have you got there, Scott? Do you remember the last three horror films, the last four, the last five?
They all sort of merge into one horrible...
Mulch.
Mulch that's a combination of Creep and all the other horrible things we've seen in our lifetime.
Darkness Falls. It's Darkness Falls meets House of Wax meets Pippi Pendril's Big Supper. That's a little project I'm working on, listeners. Originally an acclaimed six-part BBC drama, State of Play follows old-school investigative journalist Cal McCaffrey, here played by Russell Crowe, as his instincts lead him to further investigate the seemingly accidental death of a congressman's PA and mistress. Biting off more than he may be able to chew, McCaffrey finds himself embroiled in a conspiracy between big business and the government, glued together by a web of deceit and deadly assassins. Crowe is here given support from Helen Mirren, Ben Affleck, Rachel McAdams, and Jason Bateman, amongst others. But even given names like those, can State of Play survive the crunch from 6 hours to two? Drew, what would be your thoughts?
Well, I find it hard to tell whether it's survived the crunch because I've not seen the original.
Mm.
But one thing I definitely did think was that it could have done with being left as a mini-series, simply because there's so many layers in the plot and so much going on that probably would have benefited from the extra time to allow them to do it a bit more freely. Other than that, though, it's a very, very good film. One of the rare few of late that actually makes you think about what's going on, as opposed to having everything spoon-fed to you.
That's a recommendation in itself at this point in our cinematic journey, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's further proof that Ben Affleck can act, and he seems to have gone quite a raw deal over that whole Bennifer thing, which never interested me and never stopped me watching films. But
I hate that. Bennifer. Oh, my God.
I just don't read the sort of things that people talk about that in, but apparently it seems to have had quite a large effect on his career, and I don't understand why, because he's clearly quite capable.
It does seem hugely unfair, because he had up until that point proven his acting chops, hadn't he? And then just all of a sudden the press come along having coined this phrase, which neither he nor his wife particularly asked for, and he seems to have been, I don't know, he just seems to have been annihilated by it. But
yeah, I've never
there we go.
I can't really recall, because I never saw Gilly, fortunately. I can't recall ever seeing...
Lucky you.
I can't recall ever seeing Ben Affleck in anything that he was other than at least adequate. You see a lot of breakthrough film Good Will Hunting and more recent fare like Hollywoodland, that his performance in it was actually really very, very strong.
Fair play.
I certainly wouldn't like that put you off, just in case you've got any hangover from that whole brouhaha surrounding him, which I reckon seem to be sour grapes that, he's got quite a successful career, and he's banging Jennifer Lopez, the git.
Yeah, perhaps jealousy amongst the male press.
Yeah,
who knows?
I suspect so.
Scott, state of play then, are you on board?
Yep, I'm sailing that ship. I liked it quite a lot. I thought, again, it's good performances from everyone. Affleck showing not only is a good director, he's a good actor as well, in case you'd forgotten. It was odd when we were sitting down just before we watched this, and I was talking about how annoyed I was with sillier conspiracy theories that are floating around on the internet, and this film is nothing more than a whole bunch of silly conspiracy theories, yet it still manages to remain fairly enjoyable. It's I suppose to the director's credit that this makes sense all the way throughout, and it doesn't feel as though anything has been thrown at you from left field. Everything's fairly well elucidated, although the last half hour, things are getting thrown at you so thick and fast, it feels like a last-minute cramming session for an exam or something. It's just too dense towards the end, and it's a little bit off-putting somehow.
Yeah, that's... sorry, Scott, so that's particularly where I was feeling. That's where it's suffering from having been condensed so much from a mini-series, which you'd imagine being fairly pruned to begin with. And that starts to suffer towards the end because there's so many layers. Carry on.
Ah, cheers. other than that, no issues with it. I enjoyed it quite a lot. I think it's one of the stronger films I've seen this year. It's definitely the best film that we've seen that we'll discuss in this podcast, I would say. And is of all the stuff that's kicking around, is probably the one I'd recommend more than anything else just now.
Another solid entry for director Kevin McDonald, then. Now, I'm no expert in the art of pitching, but I imagine the words, "It's Starman meets Beowulf," must be quite difficult in the stack-em-high, sell-em-cheap world of Hollywood these days. Perhaps that's why Outlander is a joint US-German collaboration, bearing the faint but undeniable whiff of European cinema trying to do big budget on a shoestring. Jim Jesus Christ Caviezel plays Kanan, an intergalactic warrior whose ship crash-lands on Earth during the Iron Age, bringing with it a ferocious creature known as a Moorwen that has just laid bloody waste to Kanan's family. Following a distinctly predictable plot arc of outsider coming good with suspicious locals, Outlander seeks to separate itself from the pack with its adoption of willfully disparate story elements. Ingratiating himself with the suspicious denizens of a Viking village, Kanan seeks to avenge his family and end the Moorwen's burgeoning all-you-can-eat Viking buffet business, earning a surrogate wife and son into the bargain. John Hurt pops up to support Caviezel as village ruler Hrothgar, alongside an almost cameo appearance from B-movie legend Ron Perlman and love interest in the shape of Sophia Miles. As hard as it is to fault Outlander's ambition, it is equally difficult to ignore the eclectic makeup of its plot, much of which seems superfluous to the story. Scott, you've seen Outlander. What was your take?
Yeah, I still say it's more Beowulf meets Predator, especially with all the hunting towards the end. To be honest, this is another film I enjoyed a hell of a lot more than I've any right to enjoy. I mean, just thinking about the pitch, it does sound like the stupidest idea for a film you'll ever see. It only, I suppose, manages to make it work by pretty much ignoring most of the things that would make it remarkable. You could quite easily replace this alien thing with a dragon and
not have to bother with the effects budget on the sci-fi parts.
Exactly, you'd have exactly the same film. It would make the slightest bit of difference, so I'm not quite sure where they were going with all the sci-fi mix. fact, most of it does seem spectacularly pointless. I mean, the one of the scenes that I remember most vividly from this is where he's just crashed and he finds his big gun, and for no particularly apparent reason, just blows up a tree in the background.
In the middle of a lake.
Yeah. And then more or less immediately loses the gun, and it's never referred to again.
my gun still works? Oh, damn. There it goes.
So, obviously not the most believable stories, but other than that, it does actually seem to work quite well. I think once they've got over this, and it's thankfully it's a fairly small adjustment period of getting to know this outside stranger thing, and there's a likeable camaraderie between the sort of hunting parties that form to try and take down this big alien beastie, and I thought the effects work for something that's quite clearly not that well endowed of a budget. It was quite well handled. I thought they did a better job of convincing me that the actors were actually fighting something real rather than a green screen than a lot of other films, like, I don't know, The Incredible Hulk, to pick one example out of about a million you could name in the last couple of years. And it's not the greatest film the world has ever seen, but
it's not the greatest film, but it punches above its weight.
Yeah, for it's a solid entry in the hunting action genre, which I may or may not have just invented in this sentence. But surprisingly, and against all odds, it's actually quite a likeable film, and again, also quite highly recommended.
What struck me as slightly curious about it, but at the same time quite enjoyable, actually, was that at the first sort of 5 minutes of his meeting with the Viking village aside, Kanan wasn't constantly at odds with them, sort of struggling to win their affection. He just sort of immediately sets about helping them out with stuff and just grafting. slips into the conversation halfway through that he might have brought a ferocious man-eating monster with him. But sort of, by and large, he's given a fair shout. He's not really picked on by anyone. He's a nice chap. He gets on with everybody, and then they go and kill a monster. That's oddly appealing. Like you say, I mean, I wouldn't rush out and buy it in DVD or anything like that, but it's definitely worth a rental. It punches above its weight, and it was an enjoyable enough 2 hours in my book. It's not going to set the world alight, but for all its faults and eclecticism, you can't fault its enthusiasm. So, I mean, in a way, I'm almost surprised it's made it into cinemas, because it does sort of bear the weight of a sort of, you know, straight to video atmosphere. But more power to it, I should say. Drew, did you see Outlander?
I did, yeah.
And what did you make of it?
It's alright. I wasn't expecting a great deal from it. And my hopes weren't raised that much early on. So this seems very, very silly. But in the end, in spite of that, it's actually, it's not bad. It's struggling for budget a wee bit. I mean, John Hurt appears to be the king of 12 people. You know, it's a one tiny, tiny village. But yeah, it's not bad. There are a few bits of very clunky dialogue that haven't been thought through. Whether, you know, just the lower budget means you're constrained time-wise, but you can have a massive budget still have shitty dialogue, so that's not affecting it. And
well, to be fair, I suppose it's difficult to subtly work into the conversation of, by the way, I'm an alien, and I've brought this alien ship with me, and
it's
that thing, though, that Scott, that you mentioned.
It's just sort of the general repartee people.
Thanks for talking over the top of the host there. That's nice. There you go. Carry on.
I forgot what I was going to say now.
Yeah, so have I. Serves you right.
I was just saying that, it's not the stuff about being an alien that's clunky. It's more just some of the general repartee towards the beginning, mostly, but that was about
It's like you say, Scott, it was just puzzling that, I mean, all throughout the film he basically excuses his presence as saying, I'm from a far-off land. And you're thinking, well, you're not kidding, mate, but why not just be from a far-off land anyway in the first place? It would be, you know, it would be excusable. You didn't have to arrive in a spaceship. You could have, like, see, you could just have brought a dragon, or I don't know, a pissed off iguana or something like that with you. It's just as ferocious an enemy as pissed off iguanas were of the Vikings. But listen, I suppose if Planet of the Apes can do it for monkeys, then I don't see why Outlander shouldn't be able to do it for Spaceman and the Vikings. Observe and Report is the latest comic vehicle for Seth Rogen, easily the last year's recipient of the Brian Cox Award for Omnipresence in Film. Rogen is Ronnie Barnhart, a bipolar mall security guard tasked with bringing a prevalent flasher to justice. Unable to bring the culprit to book himself, Barnhart is forced to play second fiddle to incoming cop Ray Liotta, presumably with hilarious consequences for all. It sounds a bit too much like Paul Blart for adults to me, but Drew might be better placed to either confirm or deny that particular statement.
Yeah, well, it's pretty much Paul Blart for adults.
No, bollocks.
Although it is.
Next week on the podcast.
It's definitely a more entertaining film than Paul Blart, though. Although I'm not quite sure what this is for any reason other than the fact that Seth Rogen swears quite well. It's probably not big or clever, but it can be funny. There's not really a lot to say about it. There's Seth Rogen sort of wants to join the police, can't do it, has to be a security guard, thwarted ambitions, etc. And that's why he rubs up against a police officer played by Ray Liotta. I mean, there's not much plot to it, and then, yeah, obviously expect it's going to be some way he's going to become the hero in the end. But it sounds like there's nothing there, and there isn't, but it's still funny, and I can't really explain why, and I'm failing.
Scott, can you explain why, without failing?
Well, he's right, and it's not a particularly plot-heavy film, but it's just, for a comedy, what I appreciate most in this film, and I did like it quite a bit, is that it is the single strangest tone I've seen in a comedy for some time. It's described as black comedy, and I don't think that's really quite right. It's like a creepy comedy more than anything else. If nothing else, this deserves some plaudits as being the first film where Seth Rogen doesn't essentially play Seth Rogen. Mm. And he does actually have a character here that is somewhat different from the rest, and it's just such a strange character. And
shock horror.
It's Drew saying you think he might become the hero towards the end of the film, and to be honest, he doesn't. If anything, he gets worse by the end of the film. He's not an anti-hero either. He's just
crazy.
Evil, kind of. There is something very deeply strange and flawed about this film.
I'm just remembering the conclusion of it. It's like the conclusion is all sorts of wrong, and it's incredibly funny. He's not a nice person at all, no, Ronnie Barnhart. He's not pleasant. And so it's like a creepy comedy, and it's slightly nihilistic too, actually. And depressive, and none of these things that should be in any way funny.
That's exactly why I like it. It does so many things that are the exact opposite of what you should be doing in a comedy, and yet it still somehow manages to be funny. And I find that intriguing and also funny, which is useful because it's a comedy. So I can't really give it much more plaudits than that. It was a comedy and I laughed at it quite a lot. It's a very strange tone. I'm not sure who the target audience for this is, because it's not really... Obviously, it's pitched at more the sort of Bad Taste American Pie kind of crowd that you'd imagine, going from what I've seen of the trailers, but it's not. It's almost strangely, weirdly psychological, more like a Bret Easton Ellis book than it has any relation to American Pie films. It's a strange little curate's egg of a film, and I think that's why I liked it so much.
Fair play then. I'm at a loss for anything to say, because I haven't seen it, and I probably won't, but there you go. I suppose we can take that as some kind of recommendation then. Well, there you go then. A mixed bag, as always. Was this an above average or a below average week, lads?
I was going to say below average when I sat down to record it, but now I actually thought about most of the films, with the exception of The Uninvited. I actually quite liked most of them. So, yeah, above average, I guess.
Fair play. Here you are. That's the official forecast then for this week. It's an above average week. Haul ass if you can down to your multiplex. Do your bit to float the economy. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with reviews of, well, I don't know, all sorts of stuff probably. Films and that. Thanks for listening as always, guys. It's always a pleasure for you to tolerate us. I've remembered tonight to mention the fact that you can actually get in touch with us at podcast@theoneliner.com. A small factoid which I've managed to leave out of about, I think, the last 30 podcasts or so. And then I always complain to myself that we've never had a jot of mail. There we go. Maybe mentioning podcast@theoneliner.com as our email address might rectify that situation. We don't know. We'll just have to wait and see. I have always have been Craig. Scott, as always, was Scott.
Goodbye.
And Drew, as always, was a Drew.
Bye-bye.
There you go. Sleep tight. Don't let the bed bugs bite, or any anacondas or stuff like that, which might be in your bedroom. I don't know.
Yeah, or laser sharks or things like that.
Yeah, laser ducks. Far more likely in this country. Yeah, fair enough. Keep it real. Cheerio! Well, that was a shambles.